And welcome to the fourth episode of the Kol Nefesh Yamim Noraim Liturgical Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Schlesingau, and I'm recording this podcast during the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, I will be in conversation with my guest, Rabbi Joel Levy. Rabbi Joel is not only the rabbi at Kol Nefesh Masorti Synagogue, but also one of the Rosh HaYeshiva, the Conservative Yeshiva in Jerusalem. Without much further ado, here's episode 4. Thank you for joining me, Joel. How are you?
That's great. Nice to join you.
Thank you. We are now in the month of Elul, leading up to the Yamim Noraim period. In this episode, I would like to initially start looking at the period we're in, and then later focus on the Pi holiday liturgy. Before we get into that, I would imagine, but please correct me if I'm wrong, you've been asked many times why you became a rabbi. So rather than asking you why you became a rabbi, could you tell us about how you became the rabbi of Kol Nefesh?
I had worked in Noam for 3 years. I was then the youth director of Noam. And after that, I went back to Israel to study again. And that was my long chunk of time studying. That was a quite extended period in different institutions over a course of quite a few years. And during that time, I kept going back to the summer machane. It was the rabbi of Noam, a person who was giving that kind of religious guidance to the camp. And so I had strong relationships with the Masorti movement right way through that period. There was always a question about whether we were going to end up in Israel or whether we were going to end up in the UK. Susanna had come back to live in Israel with me in 1994, and she got a job then working first in Jerusalem and then in Tel Aviv. So getting pretty embedded in life in Israel. But there was still a strong connection to the British community. And there was always a question about whether I was going to find a way to work in the UK as well as the work that I was doing in Israel. I also received a grant. And in those days, the grant actually followed the student. So you basically just got, they just threw money at you and said, here, have some money, study for as long as you like. The condition was that in some way you'd pay back your debts to Anglo-Jewry. And so there was that sort of debt of honour sort of hanging over me that I would at some point also have to come back to Britain and do some work to pay back those debts. During those 5-6 years, I was the high holiday rabbi for different communities around the Masorti movement and also had an ongoing relationship with Kol Nefesh. And as the time when I was going to graduate approached, I was my studies with David Hartman were going to finish somewhere around 2000, 2001. I entered into negotiations with different people in the UK about what work might be available and really clicked with Kol Nefesh. I was looking for a fully egalitarian community to be involved in, the only community that at that point had made that decision to really take the bull by the horns and become completely egalitarian was Kol Nefesh. I had an ongoing relationship with Cheryl and with Jackie. And when the time came, it seemed like a very natural fit that I would find a way to come back into the shul, Kol Nefesh, and start working as a part-time rabbi there. It was very clear to us that we didn't want to come back to England at that point, that Shira was born in 1998. And I had work in the Conservative Yeshiva in 2000, and I was teaching at the Machon, the Madrichei Chul. I was teaching on the Machon as well. So I had a busy life there. And Susanna's career was doing great at the Israel Chamber Orchestra. And we certainly didn't want to ship back to England. But the idea of coming to a shul which was looking for a part-time rabbi and being able to carry on with all the things that I was doing in Israel at the same time was pretty perfect.
That sounds great. In Good. The past episodes of the podcast, we've often heard that sometimes the circumstances push us into the position where we eventually end up in. Joel, you mentioned that you're usually based in Jerusalem, but this year you're on a sabbatical in England. The sabbatical was unfortunately restricted with the ongoing pandemic. Shuls have shut shortly after Purim and only recently started to reopen in a COVID-secure way. How have you been managing?
I've been up in Cheshire with my parents. We were planning, I suppose, on using this place as a base for quite an adventurous year with lots of travelling and interesting things going on, and obviously didn't work out like that. We didn't have the year of travelling that we were planning on taking, and that's been certainly disappointing for Kalia, but it's been a very different year and a good year for us. We have plenty of space and lots of outdoors and beautiful countryside within walking distance. As soon as we were able to go walking, then we were walking a lot. Susanna's been working on her postdoc, but the rhythm has been that we got up early in the morning every day and both of us worked hard through to lunchtime. And then we've had afternoons free to play and hang out with the kids and do nice things. And we've done some nice things, so it's been good.
It's great that you're still able to find something positive in quite a challenging situation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. My younger daughter, Kalia, is somewhere between GCSEs and A-levels in Israel. So we've been doing a lot of maths together. So sometimes it's been a couple of hours of maths every day as well, which has been lovely. Getting my head around the maths that I learned when I was a bit younger has been really, really fun. No, we're just very lucky. What can I say? COVID has been brutal in physical ways. People have been very hurt and people have died in our community as well. There are people who are really suffering. And it's been financially brutal as well. People who've lost their jobs, a great deal of insecurity, not least in this part of the world. I'm certainly worried about sheltering my parents and keeping them safe. And we've put a lot of work into trying to make sure this house is really well locked down. My parents are both pretty vulnerable physically. But for me, it's been a good 4 or 5 months.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joel. Have you got a specific memory of Colnetfish that you'd like to share with us?
I'm an active member of a kihila in Yerushalayim, Mayanot, which is a slightly larger, successful egalitarian Masorti kihila in South Jerusalem. And that's where I daven on a regular basis. I would say there's basically no davening at Mayanot that moves me like the davening at Kol Nefesh. There's an intensity to the davening at Kol Nefesh when people are concentrating, which is excellent, really, really excellent. It sounds a bit silly, but I think you have to learn what it is you're actually supposed to be doing in synagogue. There's things you have to get over. Like you have to get over the idea that my voice might not sound right, or you have to get over the idea that this is some sort of passive experience, and you have to get over your theological blocks. I do or do not believe in God this morning. I think this is weird. I don't exactly know what I'm doing. You have to get over all sorts of hurdles, and you have to suspend what needs to be suspended in your disbelief or your rationality or whatever it is that stops you taking religion seriously. And you have to give yourself permission to throw yourself into it. And that can happen as an individual. I think you can learn how to do that praying in your own living room or your own bedroom. And it also happens as a community as well. Community has to learn how to do that. And the quality of the davening at Kol Nefesh has certainly really, really taken off over the years. And there are times of real intensity. There's times of real harmony, real intensity. And it can be magical. Those times when you think, you know, why am I being paid to do this? This is where I want to be. Susanna says the same thing. There's times when she is a professional musician where she'd be playing in an orchestra in the middle of the most stupendous sound, thinking to herself, I would pay to be here because this is perfect. This is exactly where I want to be. There's other times she'd come back from rehearsals with her orchestra in Israel and say, you couldn't pay me enough to do this because it's so diabolically bad. But that's the give and take. And the same is true with Kol Nefesh. There's times when it would make sense to fly around the world in order to be in a place where people were praying with seriousness and where there was an attention to that process and taking it seriously and singing together. And you think, this is exactly where I want to be. And those are the magical moments, I think. And you know, a lot of those happen over the high holidays, because so many people in the community have devoted themselves to learning and taking the liturgy seriously. And there is a critical mass of people who come to shul on the high holidays who are all committed to going into the place where you need to go at the high holidays, to going there. And when you get enough critical mass of people in a small room who are going to the place where you need to go on the high holidays and who are going there with intensity, then that's magic. That is magical. And that helps everyone. That helps other people in the room to go there too. And then it's a virtuous cycle then of people who will be drawn into that process of wanting to be there and wanting to hear that sound and wanting to be part of that sound world and wanting to put themselves religiously in that space as well. So that's the times when I think, yeah, this is where I want to be. That happens too on a regular Shabbat. Jackie leading Musaf, I'd get on an airplane to come and be part of that. There's enough going on at Kol Nefesh on a regular basis when we come together to mean that I really want to be there and the place has a kind of magical vibe to it. It doesn't matter where we do that, as long as there's a crisp acoustic and enough space for us to sit down together, then it's magical. The fact that we can't do that is the bitter taste that we're going to have after this year. I think the COVID has really brought home what community means and what it doesn't mean, like why it is that you would want to come together. We were talking last night about things that happen online that maybe wouldn't have happened otherwise. And that's also extremely powerful to think positively about what emerges from the new technologies and how they can be effective and how we can do things we couldn't do before. And I think that's all true, but the lack of community, as in actually sharing space together and breathing each other's air and getting up close, that's something that you really, really feel. And proximity is part of that. I know in the context of prayer, I'm not just talking about singing per se. It's not a choir. It's a praying community using song. It doesn't take much of that before it gets to all the right places for me in terms of kind of the depth of that experience. But that's to do with proximity. You have to learn that coming close to people is what makes that happen. It's a natural process to come close and sing and hear each other sound and be together so close that you can feel the warmth of someone and feel their breath. That really, really works. And then not to be doing that for 6 months is awful. My community in Jerusalem, Daphne's in a very large hall because we do get more people who come. And there isn't really an understanding in that community that the further apart you sit, the less intense the experience. And so, you know, you're in a big hall, you spread out and everyone makes sure they have two or three seats and the sound dissipates and you really lose spiritual intensity to what you're doing. I have an ongoing battle with the community, with certain people in the community, because I'm constantly trying to get people to sit closer together. So I'll sneak into shul before shul starts in the morning to put the chairs closer together, and then somebody else will sneak in and put them further apart. And it's pretty painful, actually, when you think that you're looking for different things in a community. But I don't feel that that struggle is going on at Kol Nefesh. I feel that people know what they're about, and what, you know, they know what it's for, and why it is the acoustic of the room is more important than the visual aesthetic of the room, and why it is that sitting close together is good as opposed to bad, and why it is that you should join in, and it makes a difference if everyone in the room is singing. You want to be in a place where everyone is doing it. So that's what I think I'm going to miss this year, and we're going to have to work really, really hard to think about and to create something else that will replace, in some way compensate for that lack in this crazy year.
Cool. I would now like to move specifically to High Holidays. You've sort of brought them in already a bit, but let's just maybe expand on this topic. These are undoubtedly the holiest days in the Jewish year cycle. What do you think makes this season so special?
The High Holidays and Pesach are exactly 6 months apart from each other. They're opposites, not just in time, but also in spiritual activity that's involved in Pesach as opposed to in the High Holidays. That in Pesach, we give ourselves the luxury of allowing ourselves to see our enemies outside, that the enemy is without Pharaoh, the Egyptians, oppression, political oppression, lack of freedom. Those are things which come from the outside. Nationhood is defined in those terms. So, you know, you're a nation in opposition to other nations. It's often very comfortable to be in that space where we externalize our enemies and we focus on ourselves as a political entity which needs to defend itself from other political entities. 6 months on from Pesach, we flip that completely. In the High Holidays, we kind of bully ourselves to see it on the inside, and there are no external enemies. It's not a mode of judgment at all. You're not supposed to be judging other people. You only stand and are judged. So the success or failure of the High Holidays rides on our capacity to not judge others, only to look inwards. We listen to the radio and we routinely say, oh, that person's an idiot, or that person's an idiot, or why is it run that way? And we allow ourselves the luxury of thinking we're not caught up in that. Whereas over the High Holidays, there's nowhere to escape. The question we're constantly asking ourselves is, when I see the defects in the world, how are they reflected in the defects in myself? And the internality of the High Holidays, I think, is where its power resides. If I'm a basically decent person, then what's the next step that I can take along that journey to be better? And anyone can ask themselves that question, but it's a hard question because it involves kind of looking very clearly at who we are and thinking what might be different. And there's nowhere to run. And that's taken to the nth degree. So to never avert your gaze over the course of the 10 days is to try and keep your gaze firmly fixed in that sense on yourself and on who you are and who you could be is relentless and very powerful. And also a bit mad as well. I mean, there's something a bit crazy about it. And the ultimate expression of that is Yom Kippur, where there's the craziness takes itself to the extent that, you know, you're prepared to just really focus on that with intensity for as long a period as you possibly can without any distractions. And you could drive yourself mad, you know, if you carried on doing that. I think anyone who tried to live in that mode of existence would find themselves crazy within a very short amount of time. You could really do yourself in. The High Holidays are a place you have to visit but not reside in. You have to go there temporarily and not permanently, because that kind of self-critical way of looking at yourself is too harsh. You can't live in that light. You have to just shine it on yourself and then stay with it for as long as you can, and then move out of it and then go back into a more normal, mundane kind of existence. It isn't a place you should stay in too long. And to stay too long within Pesach is to the opposite, is to shine a light on other people and not on yourself, to emphasize peoplehood beyond common humanity. And Jews often drift towards Pesach as a more secure place than peoplehood. But that's also a dangerous place to stay too long. The High Holidays are holidays. And we may daydream about living in the place where we go on holiday, but you mustn't actually do it. You're not allowed to actually go to the place where you go on holiday and live there forever.
Before we get to the liturgy itself, is there a custom in your family or a moment that makes you stop and realize now we've entered High Holidays?
So we have shofar blowing right way through Elul, which is amazing. You know, we have shofarot at home, and we blow the shofar every day. It's like a getting up thing. It's an after breakfast thing. It's a coming home from school thing. So the shofar is really in the house, and it's very present through the whole of Elul. And that's great. My daughter is a great shofar blower, and she's very keen to blow the shofar every day. Then you know that Elul has definitely arrived. The central mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah is shofar. It's a very simple thing. You know, if you think about the mitzvot that you have to keep on the different chagim and how complicated. Rosh Hashanah, you have to blow the shofar. And how you have to blow it is a different question. And how, you know, how do you do it? We have 100 blasts on Rosh Hashanah, and that's like an elaborate choreographed sound that you're producing on Rosh Hashanah. But blowing during Elul is very, very simple. That sound is with you for that whole month leading up to Rosh Hashanah, which is really, really important, I think. And that's one of the things that we're trying to encourage as many people as possible to take home. We live vicariously in synagogue because I can come into shul not feeling in the mood, and I can listen to davening and I can get in the mood because I can be infected in synagogue by somebody else's religious intensity. If I go close to a shalich tzibur who's praying with seriousness, I'm very quickly drawn into that enchantment and I want to be there, and that's very, very powerful. In the absence of that, then what do you do? Where you can't live a vicarious Jewish life. There's no one whose energy you can draw upon. Rosh Hashanah, you can be in shul, and the shofar blowing can get you right to the kishkas if you're in the zone and everyone else is in the zone, and we're leaning inward, straining to sort of internalize that sound surrounded by 100 people all trying to do the same thing. That can be potent in an instant, but blowing shofar in your own home, it doesn't happen the first time, it happens the 30th time. It happens because you do it over and over and over again, and you just build it into your life gently and with patience and with piety, I suppose, in the sense of commitment. Like it's a bit like exercising every day. You just do it every day. You just do a little bit every day. You don't strain yourself. You just make sure you do it. And if you blow the shofar every day, it accumulates, but you have to do it. There's nowhere to escape. There's no one else to do it for you.
Fantastic. From our discussion so far, it might not quite seem like it, but the theme of this series is the liturgy of High Holidays. Before we get to any practical examples, is there a service within the High Holidays that you find particularly meaningful?
Oh, that's a hard question. I must say, I'm drawn to the familiar. Maybe that's my character. And it's definitely true as I've got older, I am drawn to repetition. I'm particularly attracted to the moments which are built into a life of repetition. And I know that for many people, that is the exact opposite. Many people would say it's dafka, the repetition, that drives people mad in religious contexts, like the fact that we're doing the same thing over and over that drives people mad. But for me, I think life is repetitive. The challenge in life is not to find new things to do. The challenge in life is to live that repetition the right way. And it sounds good, so it sounds really stupid, but I really like Psukei deZimra in the High Holidays. I like the half an hour before everyone arrives in shul when we're just doing almost exactly the same liturgy as we do on a weekday, but it has a different nusach. That for me is really, like, I know that I'm in shul, and it sounds crazy because it's not the beautiful pieces of text and the amazing imagery that's totally unique to the High Holidays, like the Natan of Tokef, which is completely unique to the High Holidays. I think those are amazing and beautiful. You know, I'm not trying to decry them at all, but there's something that happens in the morning on Rosh Hashanah, right early in the morning, when we're just doing Psukei deZimra, it's exactly the same as a regular Shabbat or even a regular weekday. The only thing that shifts is the sound world. Psukei deZimra stays somewhat fixed right way through the year. There's a core set of psalms that we say every day, the psalms leading up to the very end of the book of Psalms, up to Psalm 150. They're said every single day. But for me, it's totally different coming into shul on a Shabbat and hearing the Shabbat Nusach for Psukei deZimra. And you know it's Shabbat. There are very few synagogues that I've been to where people daven Psukei deZimra on a Shabbat morning with the correct Nusach. And it's such a loss. It's terrible. You know, when I go into a shul on Shabbat morning and they're davening weekday Nusach for Psukei deZimra, I think, yeah, that's crazy. You've basically started the day off on the wrong foot. You've not taken advantage of the opportunity to mark this day as separate, which is what the sound world of the Nusach does. The sound world allows you to bathe in a pool of Shabbat right from the minute you come into shul, and that should be a different experience. So it's not, I don't think right and wrong is maybe the right language. I mean, people will say the sound world, it's not that it's a moral error or evil in some way not to use the right nusach, but it's certainly a wasted opportunity to have this rich musical heritage which you can then use to shape a religious experience, and then to not use it, it's just, I think, a religious mistake. The minute you set foot in shul, even with those psalms which you say every single day of the week, to come into shul on the High Holidays is to enter a completely different world, really, and the haunting musical world, which is absolutely beautiful. I think the music, the nusach for Psukei deZimra on the High Holidays is just delightful.
It wouldn't be me if I didn't encourage you now to give us a taste of that nusa. Is that something you'd be up for?
Sure. So Shabbat goes like this. Yashrei Yashrei Mitechot Yalu Chasela Ashrei Am Shekachalo Ashrei Am Shadonai Lohai Tehilat Adonai Dabepi Vivarecho Bas Hashem Kodesho Le'olam Va'ed Anachnu Nevarech Yah Me'ata V'ad Olam Halleluya Yairarai 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 Amdu. That's the Shabbat one. Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha Od Yaluha Sela Ashrei Am Shekach Alo Ashrei Am Shadonai Elohav Tehilat Adonai Yedabe Pi Vivareko Basa Shem Kodesho Le'olam Va'ed V'anachnu V'lech Yah Meta v'yad olam hallelujah. Beautiful, thank you. Your video message to the community for Elul went out last week. Is there anything you would like to say to the community going into this year's Yamim Noraim Vaedas podcast? I would just reinforce what I said both in my introductory podcast and in what I just said now, which is I would encourage people to do stuff. And I know that's a very hard thing. I think people know that I want to see people take stuff home. Judaism reinforces the idea that perhaps the most significant rituals of our life are not in synagogue, they're at home. And Judaism also has the idea that prayer is not essentially focused around synagogue. Prayer is an obligation of the individual. You don't require a synagogue to pray. That definitely puts me at odds a little bit with the community, because I think for many people in the Kehillah, the place where prayer happens is the community and it doesn't happen outside. So what's going to happen on Rosh Hashanah morning for those people who aren't going to manage or want to come together physically? And the answer is that you can do that at home, and it can be really, really powerful in your own home. Maybe more powerful, we'll see. I hope that we find a way of providing people in the community with some of the tools to have significant religious experiences in the privacy of their own home. And if we don't manage to provide people with those, either the inspiration or the tools, so then I apologize. That'll be my fault and the fault of the other leaders of the community if we fail to do that. But you don't need synagogue. Synagogue is the icing on the cake, really. It's not the cake. So the cake is prayer. The cake is your individual relationship with God, your individual attempt to make sense of life and to make sense of who we are and to try to be who we might become. That's the cake. And the icing on the cake is when we come together. But for many people in the community, that would not be a description that they would be happy with. And they've told me that.
Thank you, Joel, for joining me today, and thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Please stay tuned for further conversations with other members of Kol Nefesh about their liturgical highlights of the High Holidays. Until the next time.